Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and welcome to the program. As always, I'm joined by my most excellent panel. From LA, we have Ace Attorney, and I do mean Ace, Peter Haven. Peter, good to talk to you again.
Well, likewise. I always like being referred to as Ace. I appreciate that. It's a pleasure to be here and look forward to solving a few more problems today.
Right. And from the very center of the known universe, author, activist, and teacher, Sam Moffey. Sam, welcome.
Bob, pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to a good rousing entertainment fun talk, because we were all off last Sunday, so we all have a lot to get off our chest, I believe.
A quick question for you. It's a bit of an aside. Due to the fact that Youngstown is shrinking faster than a helium balloon in the sun, are you seeing smaller class sizes?
No, remember, the city itself is a lost cause, as a lot of cities are in the Midwest that don't, it didn't adapt and didn't change. It's funny, my wife works in Pittsburgh, and it's 60 miles from us, and Pittsburgh, most people, has actually done very, very well. So has Columbus. They changed, they adapted, they did things that cities, communities have to do. Our suburbs are doing very well. I'm in classes that are actually pretty huge, and I think it's because, we have a thing called open enrollment, where the schools can grab kids from everywhere, and obviously there's 70,000 people in the city of Youngstown. The school system is absolutely atrocious. They have 60 jobs that they cannot fill. No one wants to go there to teach. A substitute teacher was just caught bringing a 9mm gun into the school. How about that? He forgot it was in his bag. But anyway, the kids, he's an ex-politician, by the way. Long story short, because of that, if you could send your kids to the suburbs for open enrollment, they're going. So that's why the classes in the suburbs are bigger. There's all, and whatnot. So, yes, the city's in bad shape, but the county is in very good shape.
Okay, great. And from the epicenter of the pork roll, New Jersey, my good friend Bill Conrad. Bill, welcome.
Thank you, Simon. I'm looking forward that each of us will bring our tool bags to try to fix everything that's broken. I'm thinking that the way we approach things with our hammers, we ought to do a nice job of fixing things.
Okay. I am hoping that we're going to be joined by psychologist Dr. Gary Penn, but he's being notoriously late. But I'll keep an eye on the switchboard for him. Okay, on with the program. The Donald Sterling fiasco just won't go away. The news this week, Shelley Sterling apparently wants to sell the team for $2 billion. Her husband, somewhat estranged, although we're not quite sure how estranged, Donald Sterling, is suing the NBA for $1 billion. The supposed buyer of the franchise is ex-Microsoft guy Steve Ballmer. I'm wondering if he's going to change the name. I rather like the Windowsers, but that's just my theory. Peter, this is your neck of the woods. What on earth is going on?
Well, I think they're going to be renamed the Los Angeles Operating Systems is what I think they're going to be called. Well, to me, this just seems like standard operating procedure when you got this much money and this much you know, free time on people's hands. It's a lot like the McCourt situation with the Dodgers a few years ago. You know, the husband and wife were basically suing each other for divorce property rights, and Major League Baseball was in effect commencing actions against the McCourts to get them out, and it all led to a great big swirling, and then the McCourts in turn claimed back against Major League Baseball, and it all led to this big swirling mess, and at the end of the day, the Dodgers got sold, and I forget what that purchase price was, but that seems to me to be well over $1 billion. And the McCourts each made, husband and wife, each made a fortune as they walked out the door and, you know, basically laughed all their way to the bank. And it seems to me that the same thing is happening here. You know, Donald Sterling made his money in real estate, and real estate, like any other kind of investment, is all about buying your asset at the rock-bottom price and selling it at the top of the market. And by God, that's exactly what the Donald Sterling is doing. He is selling his team at the absolute peak of its value, in my opinion. This team is a popular NBA franchise. It's the best team in L.A., which is a premier market. He bought it for some minuscule amount of money. I believe he purchased it with how much? $12 million?
Yep.
Wow. And did he buy it when it was the San Diego Clippers, or did he buy it Pardon me?
He saved the franchise. They moved it from Buffalo. It was called the Buffalo Braves. He saved the franchise. It was going under.
Do I understand correctly that the Clippers originated in Buffalo and then moved to San Diego?
That's correct. They moved
They moved to San. I remember them in San Diego. I grew up in North San Diego
Buffalo
County.
Braves, they moved to San Diego. The NBA sought out Sterling to buy the team because it was in such bad shape way back in the days of early 80s.
Well, whatever he bought at bargain bottom prices.
Absolutely.
And for years, this guy was disliked for running the Clippers, quote unquote, into the ground. The joke in the league was, you know, you would be, if you were a top round pick out of college, you were going to end up playing a few years for the Clippers. You would get a nice contract. You would be on a lousy team. And then after that stint in San Diego / LA, you would be free to go out into the market and make your real money. And the Clippers were basically a joke. And now they are one of the top four or five teams in the NBA based on the last couple of seasons. They have a very popular head coach. They've got popular and superstar players on their roster. And, you know, he couldn't have picked a better time to sell. And he's going to make a fortune. And on top of that, he's going to file some claim against the NBA. And I suspect that claim will result in a settlement, and he'll make a little money off of that too, and it's all not a bad day at the office, and what he's going to do with all this money is utterly and completely beyond me. He's already got more money than God, as we like to say, and, you know, he's gonna have a few more, and then he's going to go meet his maker, and there'll be a huge brawl over who gets everything in his estate, and I'm sure his wife, Shelley, will do very well in all of this, just like McCourt's wife did very well. So another day at the office for the rich in the City of Angels.
Okay, Peter, does Shelley actually have money of her own, or is it all through the largesse of Donald?
Well, I don't know if there's any real difference. You know, I don't know what their marital relationship agreements, if any, are like. But it's my understanding that she's being advised by the law firm of Greenberg Glusker here in Los Angeles, and they're a big-time expensive law firm. And they're going to be representing her, as I understand it, in connection with the sale to this individual, Ballmer. So I assume she's got plenty of money. I assume it's her community property interest in everything that Donald has acquired, but I don't know for certain. If that's all it is, that in and of itself is a fortune, just like Tiger Woods' wife accumulated a fortune just by being married to Tiger.
Bill, any thoughts on the Sterlings?
No, I think again, he's trying to drum up more controversy in order to get a better price for this. Though, again, I'm baffled at what he needs all this extra money for. I don't know if it's just punitive against him being banned from the league for life, which I guess you can't exactly own the team and have people playing basketball in the NBA if you're banned for life. That's a problem for him, isn't it?
Well,
you know, when you're about money, we talked about this before. When money is the scorecard by which you measure your life, that's it. That's the only thing you measure. How many dollars do you have in the win column? And there are people who believe that's how you measure a person's life, by how many dollars they have in their column. So for him and for those around him, this is just the way you measure success in life. You don't need the money, but this is how you keep score. This is what you do. How many billions do you have? And that's how you measure it. And that's your entire self-value is a function of this. So, of course, it doesn't matter if you're on your deathbed. You're going to – these people will engage in this behavior, in my opinion.
Sam, you know, $2 billion, that's way too many zeros for me.
You know, I agree with the rest of the panel. But I think we go into this more deeper is that it's a real sign of how sick our society has become without the greed. How does a basketball franchise? I don't care if it's what did this make the Yankees worth $20 billion? The Dallas Cowboys or some of the more well-known teams, and I don't even think the Clippers come with any real estate. Am I right? Don't they play in the Lakers? Home place, Peter?
Well, they play in Staples Center, and I believe...
And that's owned by the Lakers, right?
I don't think so. I think it's owned by a company called AIG, and it's not AIG that you're thinking of. Maybe it's got something else, but it's owned by a company, and that company may have ownership interests in one or both teams, but they own the building. And I assume they rent it out to the Lakers and Clippers and a bunch of other entities. What are they? What's that company called?
I don't know. So the Lakers, potentially the Clippers are only a NBA franchise with no real estate. It's my understanding when the McCourts was sold, Fulton's had to sell the team. There was a lot of real estate involved, Dodger Stadium and some outlining development. Is that correct?
Yes, it's AEG, forgive me. It's AEG, and that sounds for like something Associate Entertainment Group or something like that. The Dodgers owned real estate in that they had – I think they owned Dodger Stadium, and
right.
I think they also owned minor league ballparks. I think they owned one in Vero Beach, Florida. And so there's a certain amount of real estate that goes with it. But these franchises in today's day and age – it doesn't matter whether you own real estate or not. What matters is if you're a giant cash register that basically just prints money for your owner. And I think that these real estate, I think that these sports franchises are basically that. They're just giant cash cows. And to own a team means you own the rights to the team, all of the advertising rights, the publicity rights, the rights to sell merchandise, and then you have contractual rights with the league for television contracts, and some of these TV and advertising contracts now are huge. So, when you own the right to get paid for those types of assets and commodities, you're owning a giant cash register. And a stream of income over time is very valuable, and apparently right now it's worth $2 billion to buy a franchise now, in exchange for which you get a stream of income over time, and I don't know what that income is, but I assume it's pretty large.
It's going to be. But to me, it just boggles my mind, but it also sums up what's wrong with society, our present society, where a guy's got to be worth $20 billion to afford a team for $2 billion. It doesn't employ that many people. It's a sports, they get these stadiums and stadium, the billionaires who own them and the millionaires who play for them. all doing it on the taxpayers' dime, a lot of it. Stadiums paid for by with sin taxes or tax abatements. There's all sorts of, you know, the cities paid for the security, the police get overtime.
You raise a couple of really interesting points, and one of which is the degree to which entertainment is a very important part of our society. And it is, whether you define it as the Hollywood industry, movie-making industry, sports entertainment, rock and roll music, or what have you. Media, in broadly defined, is the panacea of the masses. It is what allows everyday ordinary people to get through life and to do all the jobs that are necessary to keep society functioning and keep them happy and entertained at the same time. So it is a massively valuable enterprise, and we as a society, I agree, are incredibly overly invested in it. But societies have always been structured in a certain way on how do you keep people happy? How do you keep the people happy? Well, you give them what they want. And right now, what people are consuming in mass quantities are all these different forms of entertainment: video games, movies, television shows, reality shows, sports entertainment, wrestling, Dancing with the Stars, pornography, I mean, whatever you call it, it's just this broad-based entertainment sector. Secondly, the other issue you raised is, you know, as human beings have evolved, you know, we used to be people who hunted and gathered, and success was measured by, you know, could you kill the buffalo? Could you put food on the table? Could you build a structure that provided you shelter? These were the fundamental means by which success was measured. And now it's something else. Now success, by and large, is measured literally by how many dollars you have, because that's the translation equivalent. You know, now you don't have to build your home, but if you have enough money to buy it, then that's the same thing. Now you don't have to hunt and kill your food or grow your food, but if you have enough money to buy it, that's the same thing. And so we live in this world now where the almighty dollar is the single most important measuring stick of quote-unquote evolutionary survival. It makes you wonder if sometime down the line there won't be some other measuring stick, and I don't know what that would be. But I did see a Star Trek episode once where they said that we don't judge people by wealth anymore. We judge them by merit. And I thought about that, and I thought, I wonder what the world would look like if you judged people by something other than money. I don't know. It's something to think about.
Very interesting point to raise.
For Christmas, we're all going to chip in and buy Bill a quiet keyboard.
Poor Bill and his noisy keyboard. If only he owned the Clippers, he would have a touch screen keyboard. We wouldn't hear it.
Right. Okay, sorry about that.
Peter, Simon, and Bill, what about the accusations that was raised late Friday night and early Saturday morning that Mr. Sterling suffers from dementia and he's not incapable of doing anything, and the NBA agreed with that? So if that's the case, how do we hold a person who's mentally unstable for some bad choice of words at a moment when he didn't know he was being taped by
it's a double-edged sword, because if somebody in his camp is going to allege he's suffering from some mental defect and therefore he should not be punished for the words he said, somebody else on the other side is going to say, well, if we can't hold him accountable for the words he speaks, why should we let him run one of our franchises?
I mean, it cuts both ways, right?
And the other aspect of it is, I think that everybody in the NBA knows that this was not intended to be the kind of comment that it on its face sounded like. And I think everybody in the NBA knows that this guy's a little bit off his rocker. But what's driving a lot of this is these are comments that affect the marketability and the branding value of the NBA. I mean, this is a league that's dominated by African-American athletes and has a huge popular fan base that stretches into every major city and area in the United States. And they can't allow this kind of poison to harm that tree. They just can't.
How is he? Here's a question for you, Peter. He's affected the brand name in such a way that his team is worth more money.
I don't think that he himself has damaged the brand right now. He will damage the brand if they allow him to remain in his position unaltered. So what they're doing now, I think they've given greater value to the NBA brand and franchises by virtue of the fact that they came down on him. I think that people like that, and now they're even more. They like the NBA more, and I think they even like the Clippers more, because now the Clippers are going to be set free from this crazy, irrational owner. So I think that in many respects, this added to the value of the team. And again, I said this earlier when we were off the line, but I really wonder to what extent he knew full well that this would happen, because I cannot think personally of a better time for him to sell this franchise than right this second, absolute peak of the market for him.
Okay, but he already has more money than he knows what to do with. Peter, you mentioned earlier, he probably will shuffle off this mortal coil, in the not too distant future. Using a cricketing term, queer the pitch?
I've heard that term before, but what exactly does that mean in this context? What could he possibly, what's the potential here?
Goes ahead with this court case against the NBA. Would that in some way interfere with the sale to Mr. Ballmer?
No, it doesn't sound like that's what's going to happen. I don't know what the allegations are in the lawsuit that he – I don't know if he's actually filed it yet or not. Last I heard, he was going to sue the NBA. But if this sale agreement is already in place, it seems to me that that sale is going to go forward, and that's going to happen relatively quickly. And by this time, I would say this time next year, but it's going to happen sooner than that. By the time NBA opens training camp in a few more months, the offseason is actually very short, I think you'll have a new ownership regime in place with the Clippers. What's more interesting is I wonder what Sterling's claim against the NBA will be, what kind of damages he's going to allege he has suffered. And it's a real trade-off to me if you're going to say, I was forced out of the league inappropriately. I think what he's going to claim is they forced me out of the league. I had no choice because they stiff-armed me. They took it away, and now I'm going to sue them for damages. Now, he's still going to get the money from the sale, but then I think he's going to claim that what the NBA did to him was a breach of some duty that they owed him, a breach of some contract that they owed him, some sort of intentional tortious act that the NBA allegedly committed. But to me, it's going to be hard to measure the damages because on the one hand, he's lost a stream of payments that he could have had for the rest of his so-called life, and I mean to say that there were actuarial tables out there by somebody pursuant to which somebody would say, well, what's the life expectancy of someone like this? And they would literally pull up a table, and it would say that, I can't imagine it would say more than 5 or 10 years for someone in his demographic and his age, and they measure that versus the lump sum payment that he's going to get now, and it's hard for me to imagine that he's going to do worse by getting this money than he would have if he had kept the team. So to me, he can come up with any claim he wants, but I don't see what his damages are going to be. I assume he's going to pull at least $1 billion out of this sale, maybe more. And it's hard for me to imagine that he could have suffered any harm by virtue of being, quote-unquote, improperly pushed out of the league. And he may allege something like they damaged his reputation or some nonsense like that. But to me, it's just it's a shakedown lawsuit. He's just going to bring it, and the NBA, whenever you bring a lawsuit, the standard operating procedure is you got to pay some money to get rid of it. And I don't know, the NBA may throw him an extra 10 or 20 million just to get rid of this. I don't know. Maybe they'll throw them 100,000. Maybe they'll fight it tooth and nail, and it will end in a $0 judgment. But either way, it's just sport hunting for him. There's no downside to bringing it. It's just at this point with this kind of money, it's just a hobby. Like, what are you doing today? Ah, I'm bored. I'll sue the NBA.
Right, but what I'm hearing from you is, you know, he can bring whatever lawsuit he wants, but it's not going to slow down the sale of the Clippers.
At present, that is my opinion. I'd have to read whatever lawsuit he actually brings, but to me, it sounds to me like it's totally irrelevant and independent to the actual sale. It seems to me this team's going to get sold, and that sale's going to be approved relatively quickly, and you're going to have a new ownership regime in place, and that's going to happen soon, and it's not going to be affected by the lawsuit. Because if I understand correctly, he's given Shelley authority to sell the team. So if he's given her authority to sell the team, he's saying, I'm going to go ahead and sell. So that's inconsistent with going into court and saying, wait a minute, stop the sale. To me, he's going to go into court and say, I had to sell. You forced me to sell. You took it out of my hands. I had to do it. So now I'm going to sue you for damages for making me sell the team. And that's what I think is about to happen. But we'll see. I could be wrong, but that's my assessment right now.
Man, Sam, any thoughts?
I think Peter brings up some really great points about, you know, he's one of those guys who measures his success, his own net worth, pun intended, by the money he has. He's making a fortune. He knows he's making a fortune. He's probably going to sue them. I can see him saying something like, because of you, I have to pay capital gains taxes or something like that. You know, huge capital gains, by the way. I think he's out at this point just to prove that he is he is a megalomaniac, but he's going to want that fine drop. He's going to want the NBA to tell him he's sorry. All's well that ends well. He can go to a basketball game. His ban is lifted. His fine is lifted.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point. He may be suing just to get the lifetime ban lifted. He may be suing for that. That may be one of the...
Yeah, that's part of it. Yeah. That's part of it. He wants to be able to go to a basketball game if he wants to.
And in my opinion,
right now he can't go. You know, he literally could be like he couldn't, and even with a pair. Well, with Groucho Marx max on, maybe he could sneak into a Cavaliers game or something.
Well,
but,
It's quite possible that if he sells the team and new ownership is in place, the NBA will lift or modify the ban. It's quite possible because at that point, he's just an ordinary citizen shooting his yap.
Right. My understanding, they've already secretly voted over this weekend to do the ownership. It's already happened. It's a done deal. And by the way, gentlemen, do you know how much – is it Balmer? Is that how you pronounce his name, Balmer or Balmer?
I thought it was Balmer, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's Balmer.
Do you know what his deposit was, non-refundable?
$100 million.
$300 million non-refundable deposit.
Well – If you're putting down $300 million non-refundable, you better get the franchise. So, you didn't put $300 down thinking he wasn't going to get the team. He put it down.
Oh, no, the deal's been done. I agree with you guys. Also, I think it's very interesting. He's from Seattle, and remember that the Seattle Supersonics,
ooh,
are now the Oklahoma Thunder.
Ooh, good point.
You think
wow.
he's going to move the team for that much money, Peter?
Good point. Wow, I hadn't thought about that.
I'm just curious. I just want to throw that out there.
Oh, I never thought about that, and it's certainly within the realm of possibility, yeah.
Because, boy, if I own the Lakers, I wouldn't like the Clippers being in my backyard. You know what I mean?
Well, they're fun. It's fun to have the Clippers around when you're the best team in town, but lately they've been the doormat, and the Clippers have been spanking them. So, yeah, they definitely want them out now.
But think about this. There's a little marketing here. New identity. Get out of the Clippers. Now we're going to be the Seattle. They'll bring back the Seattle Supersonics. We're going to bring
that team back.
He gets his new arena. It's a now new brand. Everyone in Seattle's happy. Come on.
Well, now they're definitely going to call them the Seattle Window Operating Systems now. I mean, that's going to be perfect.
I can see them moving. I think that's part of the deal, and that's why you pay
they're
going to
be called. They're going to be called the Seattle Outlook.
Remember the Seattle Pilot? Wait a minute. They'll call them the Seattle Braves.
They're
going to
call them the
Braves,
Seattle.
They really were.
They're going to call them the Seattle Contacts.
Yeah, but that's why I think he paid so much money for the team. I have, along with one, he could, but two, I think he just wants to move them back to Seattle. That's where his home base is. That's where Microsoft is. And I think that's what's going to, that won't surprise me if that happens. It's probably good for the league.
The Seattle PCs. I love it.
The downside would be if they did move to Seattle and a couple of the players were caught abusing drugs, they'd be known as the Space Needles.
Well, they're calling the Seattle High.
Seattle High. I like that. That's better.
I love it. I think it's fantastic. The NBA couldn't be more happy beside itself with joy. They're going to get a franchise in Seattle. They've already got one in L.A. It's perfect.
Bill, you've been very quiet. Anything to chime in?
Well, I did stop typing on my keyboard here as I was looking up for facts and figures and everything, and to which we've already breezed by it, but I really like the idea of them moving to Seattle if that's on the plate. I did look up to see that Mr. Ballmer's net worth is $20 billion, and Mr. Sterling is only sitting just below $2 billion. So this is, you know, the sale of this could potentially double his net asset. I also went out to the actuaries to find out what his lifespan is, and it's they're saying 2 to 5 years. So this is, he wants to go out with a lot of thunder. He's been embarrassed by getting caught of being a racist, and he truly needs to redeem himself with some money. And I think if you can double your net worth, I guess that's good for him, right?
Right. Well, except he won't be doubling his net worth because he has to share it with Shelley. And my guess is out of the $2 billion, the IRS are probably going to want pretty close to $1 billion of that because it would be declared as income. I'm not a tax guy. Peter?
Well, I think generally speaking, you're right. It's income, and I assume it's the same with real property. It's basically considered capital gains, and I don't know how it works in terms of how much of it is subject to taxation and all of that, or what the tax rates are, I should say. And it's probably a sophisticated tax question, but at the end of the day, I think you're right. A big chunk of that will be subject to will be gobbled up by taxes. Although, you know, these guys with their fancy accountants and tax lawyers and all that, they have ways of turning a $2 billion sale. They could probably write something up to make it look like a complete and total financial catastrophe and business loss. So,
right.
You know, I mean, it's a lot like, you know, these tax returns you get of these rich politicians, you know, they make a fortune and somehow at the end of the day, they're holding up their hands going, I lost money last year. I don't have to pay anything. So, you know, there'll be some of that going on, but basically Uncle Sam will take a chunk and Shelley will take a chunk and there'll probably be a few other people with some mouths to feed and their hands out. But, you know, I don't know what he's going to take home at the end of the day, $500 million, $1 billion, $750 million, whatever it is. It's so much money for a person at that age. It's so much money for any person at any age that, you know, I mean, what difference does it make what the dollar, how many zeros there are after this number? It's not going to change anything. It's more money than any one person could ever really need. And, you know, it's kind of disgusting, but what can you do?
Right. I'll tell you what. I've had enough of the Sterlings. Let's move on. Peter, you mentioned food earlier on in the program. Have you been following the nonsense going on in Washington about Michelle Obama's drive to get better food in schools?
I saw a little bit about that, and I don't quite know what the hubbub is all about. But you know, I don't know what she did or what she said. But as a general rule, I think that, you know, we all need to have better food, access to better food, and I certainly think it's true for children. What did she do specifically?
Oh well, the GOP are pressing for a 1-year suspension or a grace period for schools to put salads on the lunch menu because kids don't like them.
So see, that just sounds to me like the GOP opposing for the sake of opposing. I mean, what? So they don't want they think that there should be a 1-year hiatus before salads are put on the menu because it's going to take kids 1 year time to get used to the idea of eating a salad. And what's the point of giving them a salad now when they're not going to eat it?
Right. Exactly.
So, you know, to me, that just sounds like one of these arguments by people who just want to be obstructionist and adversarial. And they just want to find some way to oppose anything. And they'll latch on to any argument they can. You know, whatever the issue is, if they don't like the person raising the issue, they'll oppose it. They did this, you know, with Obamacare. They did this with, you know, this happens with every gun control debate that ever exists. It's just opposition for the sake of opposition's sake and for no other sake. And, you know, what can you do? That's living in a democracy. God bless them.
And Sam, you're a teacher. Although I doubt you have to deal with lunch duty. Yeah, what would you prefer to see?
That's a bad assumption on your part.
Right? Okay. I mean, what would you prefer to see kids eating? You know, birds and fries?
Well, I am shocked. Since I took this new position, I am shocked at actually the amount of children of all races, color, and creed who come in for the free breakfast.
Who come in for what?
Okay, free breakfast. Free.
Oh.
Paid for
it
by
is the most important meal of the day.
Paid for by everybody but Donald Sterling and Steve Ballmer because they probably don't pay taxes. I agree with you, Steve. Yeah, Peter. All us other people pay lots of tax dollars and to the system, and I'm amazed at how many kids are in there at all different school districts eating a free lunch, breakfast, excuse me. Lunch, I would say a third of the kids' brown bag, and it appears that their parents do give them healthy food. And those kids are healthier just by looking at them. They are healthier, it's just common sense. Those eating, let's face it, you know, they're getting lots of starch, lots of Monsanto, lots of Kraft food. They're not getting good food. They're getting nutritional food, calorie-wise and all that, if you can call it nutritional, but it's not. The schools will have to make money, and they're going to pay the least amount of money for their product, that's that. It looks like when they do desserts, the desserts are healthier and better tasting than the actual food. The portions are really small, at least as I remember it as a kid. We used to get big portions. Then whatever school district I'm in, regardless, every Friday has pizza day. And it appears that each school community has a favorite son or daughter pizza franchise that sells the pizza to them probably on a discount, but probably on a volume. They make a lot of money. Like the other day, Friday, I was in Austintown. Their pizza guy is Pizza Hut. Pizza Hut, you know, it's a bare-bones pizza, you know, that they do in Struthers. That's another town. It was Papa John's. And every Friday they get pizza. That's the one day the kids don't brown bag it.
Wow.
They love their pizza. We love our pizza in this country, in Mahoning County. By the way, Peter, my oldest son complains about the lack of good pizza in Southern California. He says he got all the best foods in the world up there, but he has yet to find a really good pizza. And one of that reasons is he's been spoiled because of where I live. We do have some of the best, not the chains, but some of our local small pizza people. Just incredible food.
You know, I'm appalled.
So he's been, I mean, he asked me once, asked me, Dad, can you send me a Bellaria? Overnighted to me. I was craving pizza, and he just says he can't find any. And I find that funny. As far as the foods go, it is amazing, guys. You know, forget about the politicians, and you know, I know the local school boards. You know, bribes, you know, with campaign donations, and probably get free food and whatnot from the food vendors. There's so many different food. I'm amazed at how many different trucks pull up to deliver the food to the school. So there's a lot of money. There's a lot of money in the school district, guys, and I'm sure there's a hell of a lot more in Southern California. And the one who can, the school board that controls the first thing, that's what it's all about. But I will say, and I repeat myself, the parents that do brown bag, send their kids into brown bag, have their acts together, and you can tell by the kids are healthier, they look healthier, they're a little bit more alert. I keep attention to this stuff. I go, I'm amazed that the parents, the kids who get brown bags, the kids who get this, they're the best students I have. Because obviously they're getting good support systems in their family. Not to say that all of them are perfect. Not to say that all the kids that are, you know, running around, you know, getting the food, you know, the food is bad. But you know what's really interesting? The kids that are on school lunch programs all have a credit card. And it's a good... It's a credit card for the school system gives them, you know, time, and the kid, in the first, in the kindergarten, it's number, you know, Ralph Smith, number one, when he gets, he'll keep that all the way up, as long as he's in the school lunch program. And then they run the credit card, they swipe it, you know, it's the swipe generation, I call it. they just swipe it, and there's a credit, and because one of the things I've been amazed when I go into school, first thing, homeroom. The school system is incredibly focused on taking attendance. That's the most important thing, attendance. And I'm thinking, oh, that's a good thing. You know, look, and I know they don't have truant officers. These kids aren't running around. I did a little bit more research on it. I found out it's because in the state of Ohio, and then the federal government backs it up with a little equity sweetener, I like to call it, the better your attendance is, the more money you get from the state on top of the property taxes that each community pays. So you thought the VA was bad about fudging numbers. I bet you the school districts in Ohio lie like crazy when it comes to how many kids are in their schools because of the money that's involved coming back their way from the state and the federal government. Someone ever did a forensic accounting on that, there'd be a lot of school superintendents committing hairy-carry.
Wow. The whole business about child obesity just bugs the crap out of me. Bill, your kids are grown and have flown the coup, but, you know, think back to when your kids were in the school system. Wouldn't you want them to have good nutritional food rather than just plain starch?
Well, let's back up. My kids have not flown the coop. I have one that's in college, but mom packs him a wonderful lunch. We have leftover things like chicken cutlets, and they always get nutritional sandwiches. They were brown baggers. They get good food. but what they see on the menu is my one who's in high school says, I wouldn't want to eat some of that stuff. In fact, one of the things that they call the new program that's supposedly more nutritious than it was, they call it dumpster derby because the amount of food thrown out because it's an edible is phenomenal. In fact, a lot of school systems have had to increase the number of dumpsters on their property because there's so much food being thrown away. So I am a big fan of good nutritional food, but it's got to start with the family. The school can't step in and try to provide something because they're looking out for themselves. Whatever private company is cooking the meals, because it's not somebody's mom anymore. It's a private company that has a contract with these schools, and they're not getting good nutritional food. They're trying to go overboard with this thing, but I think if they would have found a happy medium between everything floating in grease as opposed to stuff that tastes like sawdust as called organic or something like that, the cost wouldn't have gone up that much, and the kids would actually consume it. That's where I am.
Right. You know, I think back to my childhood days. We actually had highly nutritious meals. Spotted dick and custard. you can't beat that as a way to make you nap your way through the afternoon. But honestly, this GOP move, I think is unreasonable. Bill, you're right. Maybe they need to rethink it, put it somewhere in the middle. Maybe not every kid likes vegetables, but I like vegetables. I was grown up. I grew up loving vegetables because I was used to them. Kids today don't ever see a vegetable. They just go, ooh, I'm not eating that. But what really appalled me was Sam's comment about Fridays being pizza day. That's got to be a huge drain, money-wise. If you're going to make pizzas, make pizzas. But regardless of the deal you're getting from Papa John's or Pizza Hut.
You want to hear something funny, Simon? When I was a boy, and all of you guys were boys years ago, and now, of course, the population in Youngstown is bigger and whatnot. The churches used to have the volunteers would come into the churches. They would make pizzas, really good pizzas. They would donate them to the schools. Pizza Day's all, and now, so that's evolved from, that's now evolved to, they could never get that done nowadays because somehow 3/4 of the churches are all gone and the volunteers are all gone with them. But that's what it used to be like. That's what the tradition of Mahoning County, big pizza place. Pizza was always fried at the schools, and delicious, by the way, homemade. One of your best friend's mom or grandmother, probably from the bakers, volunteered to the church. It's now been replaced by the money chain, and that's what it's all about. I'm just utterly amazed at how much money just in my little local school districts that I go to. It's like everything else. It goes all the way back to what Peter was measured by how much money they have. So our districts are measured by how much money they save, how much they spend. They don't save anything. The administrators, the school boards, I'm amazed these school board members, they run around acting like little Congress people. They're crazy. But they have a lot of power. They didn't get paid that much money. So why would you want to be on the school board and have someone calling you at your house screaming to you about little Johnny's bus didn't drop him off right, the quality of the food. No one calls about the quality of the education. Or the biggest things are in the local school boards have been over the last couple of years. Who's going to be the new head football coach? And can we use cell phone usage in schools? That's been the two biggest issues that that packed a school board meeting in Mahoning County. And other than that, the school board members and the superintendents and their administration have carte blanche on what's being taught, why it's being taught, what type of money is being spent, and what have you. I mean, I don't know about Bill, Simon, or Peter's school district. The thing that really, really pisses me off, I'll see school bus after school bus, maybe with five kids in it, drive by. What a waste of taxpayers' money. Gasoline, diesel fuel, whatever, the school, the mechanics. The parents are driving the kids to school and picking them up, whether it's at the kindergarten level, and of course you get to the high school level. Heck, there's more BMWs in the parking lots than there are, you know, at a BMW dealership. And yet you see a bus go by with three people in it. So why has that not been eliminated and changed? I don't know if your system's like that too, but ours are because of the money that are involved.
It is scary. I used a school bus. I lived 3 miles from the grammar school, and it was always full. Yeah. You know?
If you get stuck behind a school bus in Mahoning County, let's say there's some people on it, they don't have bus stops anymore. If there's seven kids in a row who live in seven different houses, one after another, the bus drops them all off at each house. I'm thinking to myself, why can't you drop them all off at the corner? We just walk, take a little exercise, and be good for the little legs. The bus really is like a chauffeur, you know, just drops them all off. They don't even have bus stops anymore. It's just it's insanity. It's common sense out the window. The buses that have people on them. The majority of them are parents. I live on the main street. We have a elementary school right by our house. More parents drop and pick their kids up than take the school buses. And the buses are there. They will pick up everybody. The buses do want to pick up everybody. And so do the bus drivers, I'm sure. But And it's just thinking, what a waste. I mean, literally, with the price of gasoline or diesel. And it's funny. I get to sit there and go, I'm a cynical man, as you all know. So I'm thinking, now I know why people want to be in the school board. I wonder how much British Petroleum is paying, because they have the contract with this where I live, school district. I wonder how much they gave to each campaign of these people. And no one ever runs against anybody for school board. The school board, if someone retires, they find someone that they endorse to be on the school board. And they're secretive, and it's crazy. I'm sure it's like that in many, because it's one of those things we've all lost control of is even our local governments. And the school board used to be the epitome of that.
I think a lot of people probably – you know, we've become a society where everybody commutes on their own, and the idea of taking the bus in any form is sort of is just not very popular anymore. But I also think, and this may end up being a segue here, but I also think a lot of parents may have concerns about safety, and they may have concerns about, well, I don't want my kid dropped off at some location 6 blocks from my house. I want him right in front of my house because I'm concerned about him. Or some parents may think, I don't feel good about having a kid on a bus with a bunch of other kids in today's day and age. I don't know if somebody's going to target the bus or what's going to happen on the bus or if there are going to be bullies on the bus. I think some of that has to play into it as well, although I don't think that's the only thing that's going on.
All right. I've had enough of schools. Well, no, I haven't had enough of schools. Peter, you're right. It was a great segue. Let's talk about the stabbing and shooting spree in Isla Vista. University of California, Santa Barbara. Once again, the gun debate is going to ramp up. Peter, will it do any good?
No, I don't think so. I think that this will once again raise the issue, but you know, nothing's going to be more horrific than what happened at Sandy Hook. Nothing, in my opinion. Well, I hesitate to say that. Yeah, you know, God knows what's coming down the pike. There's another incident coming down the pike. I don't know what it's going to involve, but it may actually be more horrific than Sandy Hook. But you know, this incident, as awful as it was, it wasn't as horrific and shocking and terrible, in my opinion, in the public eye, as Sandy Hook was. And Sandy Hook,
or Aurora.
Or Aurora. Aurora, too. But there's just something about children and little children, 6 and 7 years old, and at their school playing in the playground. And, you know, there's just something horrific about that. And it to my mind, it seems even more horrific than Aurora, which in and of itself was also shocking and horrific. But if these incidents don't result in change, and in my opinion, they didn't and they won't, then I don't think the incident in Santa Barbara with a crazy college kid is going to change very much. I'm sorry to say, I don't know if anything's going to change anything with regards to the proliferation of guns in our society. And If there's going to be some event that's really going to wake people up and make them change their minds, then it has to be even more horrific than these incidents. And I'm sorry to say that we may actually have such an incident. You know, it may actually happen. But, you know, the whole thing is just tragic, and I don't think it's going to result in any kind of change. And, you know, it's another day in the life of America. This is what it's like to be an American. You walk around and you don't know when somebody's going to pull a gun on you and shoot you. That's it. That's welcome to the greatest country on earth.
You know, Sam, what are your opinions on the on this latest atrocity? Yeah, do you think there's a better need for some gun control?
Well, I think, like Peter just said something, it stole my thunder in a way, because I'm going to bring some minor statistics out. Welcome to America. Memorial Day weekend, last weekend, in Cleveland, there were 4 murders, 21 felonious assaults. Myrtle Beach, there were 5 murders. Chicago, there were 6 killings, 16 wounded. New York City, 7 shot shootings, 2 stabbed, 31 wounded. I could go on and on and on. I'm sure you guys could agree too. Welcome to America. This is what it's going to be. And let's face it, and I think guns are bad enough. This guy took people's throats, ran him down with his car. If he could have, I'm surprised he didn't try to burn with the padlock the doors of his wardrobe and then set it on fire. I mean, this guy was going to kill no matter what. And so in this case, the guns were just one of the many weapons at his disposal, obviously. This is a sick individual, and he slipped under the radar, even though the radar was on him. His family was on him. He's been seeing a psychiatrist or a psychologist for years. He blamed his manifesto was incredibly crazy, but you know, how he was walking free with thoughts like that, I mean, that's a whole other issue that I think the state of California and other people have to start looking at is, you know, just Friday I had a kid who just went absolutely ballistic. I mean, just crazy, out of the blue. He's 7th grader and, you know, and weren't allowed to do so much as he could. But my fear was this kid, you know, I made him, you know, I held him down. And other kids went and got some other teachers and guidance counselors and whatnot. I made them go through his backpack, go through his block. They weren't going to do it. They weren't going to do it. I said, I think based upon what's going on, and, you know, this kid, I don't know, you need to start checking this stuff. Let's look through his backpack or look through his locker to see what's going on. I mean, I'm only a substitute teacher here, but this young man has some serious anger issues to do what he did in the class. And he was angry at some of the other students. He's a new kid. And they picked on him or bullied him or whatnot, and he responds in a very violent manner. So, you know, but it seems like the teachers, the associates, they looked the other way, too. Granted, it's really not – on one hand, you know, how much can they do? Because as you were talking, Bill, about food, you know, look at the parents that really care. They prepare themselves. They bring better food for their kids. They care about the kids' nutrition. The school isn't. How much do we have to do? Because the school points the fingers at the parents. The parents point the fingers at the kids. And the bad kids point the fingers at the other kids with a gun in their hand. And that's got to stop, or a knife, or whatever. How do you end that?
You know what I think is going to happen? I foresee a time in the not-too-distant future where schools just become... You're talking about school buses becoming obsolete. Nobody wants to take the school bus anymore.
Yes.
Well, I can foresee a time when nobody wants to go to school anymore.
Peter, it's a brilliant. I'm reading a book called Digital Natives, Teaching Digital Natives.
Yeah, you're going to be. Everybody's going to have. They're going to have a big computer screen and a big internet Skype connection or whatever, and you're going to sit at home, and some teacher will be in some classroom, and she'll be talking to you, or he'll be talking to you, and you'll be sitting at home taking notes, and there'll be a test on Friday, and everybody will have the so-called benefit and security of staying at home. I mean, that's
probably
not too far off.
I think you have cost savings that'll be passed along. But, you know, I can't, you know, when I come into class and I'm a substitute, and I'll come in, and the teacher's thing will be, okay, class, on the page 456, the groan that comes up. You know, but it's because if I could say to these kids, get out your cell phones and let's Google, the fastest one to Google Peter Haven's law cases, okay, decisions. They'd have a ball. They would love that stuff. They do love that stuff. They do it in study hall and stuff. You know, the fastest one to Google supercalifragilistic, you know, stuff like that. They love that. Because they are incredibly, like my grandkids, you know, are incredibly gifted with what they can do. I had special ed class a couple weeks ago. The teacher was just out of college, but she was really, really good. Those are your best teachers, by the way, the ones fresh out of college. They're energetic and ready to go, and they want to try stuff. The stuff she was teaching these kids by using a huge screen computer, and they were learning shapes. Now, they were special ed, so they're behind. But, boy, did they get into learning about shapes, colors, numbers, and letters from the programs that are being written at Microsoft, at, you know, Dell, wherever they're being written, and at Apple and whatnot. It's incredible. So I think they learn more. As you know, we have to learn, it can't be the old textbook routine anymore. Because outside of school, gentlemen, think how much they can learn just by going on with their iPad and their tablet, how many books they can read on a Kindle. They learn in 2 hours.
Yeah, that's really amazing. You know, when I was a kid, if you wanted to learn about something, you had to go to the library and find a book. And now, forget it. The whole world is your library, and the internet is your medium, and you can look up anything you want about anything you want. So, you know, it's an amazing day and age we live in. You know, we don't need a lot of this stuff anymore. A lot of the old conventions to teach. We all have access to an unlimited world of information.
Herein lies the rub. Okay. If you rely on online, number one, lots of the information is not quite true. Know your source. The second problem is learning online takes a lot of self-discipline because it's easy to goof off. You know, if the class is boring, I'll go on to Facebook, you know, or whatever. How are you going to fix that?
Well, it's an interesting question. I'm sure Sam has some thoughts on it. But you know, to me, it's a question that asks, well, what's it like now? I mean, to me, I can see kids in a class, and they have their little Kindles and iPads and what have you, and if they get bored, they start accessing it. And I suppose the teacher can say, I see you in the back, Johnny, but I don't know. A lot of these kids are pretty shrewd and pretty able to, you know, they could hold a book up and they could have an iPad in there and they could just be surfing the internet. So it's, to me, the temptation's maybe a little bit greater, But education always comes down, or at least not always, but oftentimes it really comes down to the motivation of the student. And if a student is motivated, they're motivated. And if they're not, they're not. I do think there's problems with accessibility to technology, and I think you have socioeconomic concerns. I think you have some classes of people who can't afford a lot of the technology or as good of the technology, and I think something has to be done to make it more accessible to them, and maybe that's cheaper than providing school buses. I don't know. There's safety concerns. There's safety concerns. All kinds of
right.
things.
Hey, several years ago, actually, I think it was probably about 8 years ago, I wrote an essay titled "The Digital Divide," and that's what you're talking about here.
Yeah, there is a growing divide between the people who have access to technology and all the abilities and things that technology provides, and the people who don't. And that is going to be that mountain range is going to get taller. That cavern is going to get wider. And you know, you really got to get yourself into being comfortable with technology, or you're going to be left behind, unfortunately.
But if you can't afford the technology, you're toast.
That's an interesting problem. I do think that people are very ingenuitive and creative in finding ways to access technology. So, I mean, I agree with you. It's a tremendous problem when it becomes prohibitively expensive. But people do find a way.
And Sam, do you see the digital divide in your travels, or are you in one place for such a short time that it really doesn't rear its ugly
head? It all depends on the school system, its dedication to progress. Or it's stonewall thinking about it's our way or the highway, status quo. It's always worked this way. Let's keep it this way. There's some of the schools like those that are wired right and use the computers right. Not just the motivation of the student, Peter. I agree with you on that. It's also the motivation in the of the teacher to embrace. New change. Manny sent me a book called Teaching Digital Natives, when you're a digital immigrant. I consider myself a digital immigrant. I know a little about computers and whatnot, but I am and I can do function, I do Word, you know, I can do spreadsheets, I email, do all that sort of stuff. These kids can do incredible stuff. And so they're the natives. I'm the immigrant. And it's a great book, and this teacher, he's from California. He's trying to get the biggest problem is trying to motivate school systems to change. They have the technology. They can buy the programs. Like I said, my daughter, we have a 7-year-old. She's a 7-year-old daughter and a 3-year-old daughter. The 3-year-old, because of the difference in the technology, was able to pick up on, she can do her alphabets or shapes and colors and whatnot faster than my at a quicker age than my 7-year-old granddaughter could, only because of the technology and how they, you know, they've made it simple. I'm just amazed at what I see. So I'm all for it, but I think the immovable object is they're going to be the school boards, the politicians, the teachers' unions, all that stuff. They don't want to. I mean, how about the textbook people? Can you imagine the outcry from them?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, think about all these people's arches are going to get gored from the technology. On the same token, there's all sorts of other things going around. I can't stand the state of Ohio. They're obsessed with these testing. Kids have to pass a third-grade test. It seems the whole year or the whole quarter is spent by the school system or the school and the teachers trying to get their kids to pass the standardized test, which isn't standardized at all. Because they're teaching them to pass the test and not educating them. And that boggles my mind. I mean, the hell with that stuff. Let's educate these kids. Let's get them going. Let's you know, there's so much to do out there and learn and to engage more. And I only say this because I'm new at this. I'm 54 and I'm new at it. I'm looking at teachers in their 30s and 40s, pretty burnt out. I mean, it's just emotions. It's tolerable by the lesson planning and whatnot. I mean, with all the stuff that you fingertip, this is what you're teaching the kids. This is how you teach them. No wonder the kids are bored. Peter, you're 100% right. I used to hide Mad Magazine in my textbooks when I was bored. These kids can hide, and I got away with it. Well, they're doing the computers. I know. You still have Playboy magazine in yours.
Gentlemen, you'll excuse me for a minute. Gentlemen, sorry, Simon, I'm at the office today and someone just came in. I have to take care of it, but I'll be right back. Just excuse me for a few minutes, okay? Thank you.
No problem. I want to bring Bill into this conversation before I tell a story which will likely make me sound just as bad as Donald Sterling. Bill, do you have any thoughts?
I actually have a positive spin on this whole topic. I took some online college courses a few years ago, and it was a marvelous experience. One of the courses that I took was education and technology in a digital age. And what that essentially was using the internet to educate people of diverse backgrounds in diverse parts of the world, remote parts of the world, in order to get them a very good, well-rounded education. One of the places that we looked at was an island off of, I guess it was part of New Zealand, in which they were high school students that were part of the school system of Hawaii, in which they would come into a room in which there were some very good teachers who would instruct them. It had a big screen TV. It had the whole bit. It was a big video conference between the classroom in Hawaii as well as there in the Fiji Islands, and they it was amazing. They would learn from guest teachers. Sometimes they would come from college campuses that they would bring in from around the globe. These kids were intuitive. They were became sharper. And after the class, as a group, they would come together and do their research over the internet and everything else and have some social interaction with each other. So it was a positive experience in which they would have not got the same kind of education as somebody living in I'm in the New York, New Jersey, Philadelphia metropolitan area where the educational system is kind of stellar. So I watched that. We were also introduced to a lot of things on the internet that actually could educate you. There was things on YouTube that were educational as opposed to just people like us making fun of other people and goofing on others. It was a marvelous course, and I could see that, again, this was college age, and it was an intro of a few people in high school. I can see that you could do something from your home. You know, it took a lot of discipline. We had a syllabus in which we had to meet certain things by certain days of the weeks. The way, if we didn't have any live chats, we would also be posting things on blogs in which we were required to having so many interactions with other people in the group. It was a all around positive experience for me, and I could see how you could start implementing that so you could have guest teachers. You could have scientists from all over the world teaching your children and bringing them up to a higher level of education. So I would be in favor of doing some kind of a phasing in like that in the school systems. What it does to your local teacher, I'm not sure, but I would think that having the access to famous authorities on certain subjects would enrich a kid's interest and usability of training them for the future. So that's where I am.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you a story, and this will probably get me branded right up there with Donald Sterling. I ran an adult education computer lab. Basically, it was for the have-nots, going back to the digital divide. Life was great. The local community college contacted me and said, one of the things we do is English as a second language. We would love to have some of our students learn a little bit about computers and stuff. Would you be prepared to host it? And I said, oh, sure. Come on down. And a couple of weeks later, I was contacted by another organization that was again interested in ESL, primarily for younger people, in the 16 to 18 year old range. That they were new immigrants. Actually, most of them were refugees. And I said, "Oh yeah, sure, come on down." And I discovered something amazingly interesting. The folks from Asia, they could pick up concepts immediately. The people from Eastern Europe, it took them a little longer, but they understood what the goal was. These are things that I need to know. And the last group were mainly refugees from parts of Africa who thought that, technology, I've got no use for it. Now, I'm obviously painting with a broad stroke here, and I mean no disrespect to anyone or any nation, but it really did give me pause to thought. Sam, have you encountered this disparity, which I
yes.
believe is part of the digital divide?
Yes. Yeah, I think you're spot on, Simon. I mean, just that's that's the one thing we're facing, the digital divide. I mean, whatever you want to say, I think that it's it's with us and it's here to stay. It's how we embrace it. Bill, I have to take online classes to the state, and I have a great experience with it. I'm motivated to do it. It's well done. The graphics are fabulous. The instructors are great, all the instructions, and I can go at my own pace. I'm okay with that. And it's like other people are too, based upon our busy lives with family and this and that. And I think, Simon, you're high-tech savvy, and you use a degree of caution. Hey, you can't believe everything you read online. You're absolutely right. And it's funny you mentioned that. Wikipedia is blocked out in every school district I'm at. Isn't that funny? Because they don't want the kids to learn from that. We're throwing away. It's good, the kids have to do it, but let's be honest. We all both know. I mean, three of us, and Peter was on. I'm sure he'd agree. The kids
I'm back.
Today's
I'm back.
World. Oh, the kids in today's world can learn more outside of school. Once they've got the basics down, they're learning more from across the world, you know, they're talking to people. They may be watching a video from some scientists talking about global change, global warming from Iceland, that they're not getting it in the local school district. They may be watching, not all of them are watching YouTube goofy things and stupid things. They're not. They're motivated to learn, to be educated. They're probably talking to students their own age in chat rooms and doing all sorts of stuff. And, you know, and I think that's great. And and that's what has to be incorporated into the system. I'm wondering, like, Bill, you brought up a great point. Could you imagine a school of the future where you're at wherever you're at your house or whatnot, but your classmates are from all over the world? I mean, it's going to happen. It's probably happening right now.
Yes.
Engaging them in debates and things of that nature. I mean, I think it's mind-boggling what can be done. It's going to be who's going to allow it to happen. And who's going to have the balls and backbone to make these changes that need to happen. I mean, I've talked to some people, they wish the Little Red Schoolhouse, they think that we should be in a one-room schoolhouse so they can, that way it's controlled. Because one of the things I despise as a substitute teacher that go around, and I've gone to private and public schools, is teaching through fear. And the yelling, the screaming by the instructor, the complete silence, complete this and that, or you're going to get a detention. I thought that was passé, but it's not. You know, you get more fries with honey than you do with vinegar, but I'm amazed at how many of these instructors or administrators are living in the Wilson Bucky era when it comes to educating kids.
You know? Peter, you missed part of this conversation, but you likely have caught up. What's your opinion on education?
Well, in many respects, I think that education is just another aspect of our society, and as we have advanced, we've evolved. And everything about our life has gotten better, and it's also gotten worse all at the same time. You know, we're living longer than we ever used to live as people, but we're pumping in all kinds of bad things into our bodies that our society is manufacturing and shoving down our throats. Medical care has gotten simultaneously better and also worse. Athletic performance has gotten better, and it's also gotten worse in the sense that it's more enhanced with performance-enhancing drugs and what have you. And I think education is the same way. I think in many respects we've evolved and we're capable of educating people much better than we ever could before. We have many more tools and resources at our disposal. We're much more capable of providing a better education. And at the same time, the environment and the various things that creep into it have gotten worse. And now our children are, you know, they're tantalized by all kinds of diversionary media. There are all kinds of distractions. There are all kinds of increased pressures and difficulties at school. We've already talked about the school diet. You know, generally speaking, I think it's like everything else. It's gotten better, and it's also gotten worse. And, you know, it's just we're continuing to overcome these challenges that keep flying at us, and we're gonna keep doing that until something gives. We either get it right or something breaks, and then we got to start all over from scratch.
Okay, let's move on. Did any of you watch the interview with Edward Snowden?
Oh, our good friend. How's he doing? Did not watch it.
Okay.
I watched the interview with someone better, Peter.
Who?
About Edward Snowden. Daniel Ellsberg was fabulous.
Oh, my goodness.
That was excellent. I read excerpts of the Snowden interview, but I've already seen enough about him. What's going on. But Ellsberg's commentary, who was the Snowden of his day, was excellent. I don't know if you saw that, Simon. Did you?
Yes, I did.
Did you like that?
Yes, I did. Earlier this morning, I did actually sit through the 42 minutes of Snowden, and I found it illuminating. He's a mental giant in his own mind.
Yeah. On the same token, Bill, I want you to chime in. Do you think when he said that he has been a spy? Just a typical, not just a contractor, but he was legitimately a spy, doing things for the CIA and the NSA and all that stuff. Did you believe him? I believe him, and I believe him. And he was a spy who was told, who finally blew the whistle, so to speak. And I do believe him, and I think people need to realize that. And of course, what Ellsberg, people are calling for him to come home. Well, when Ellsberg, from the Pentagon Papers fame, said that, of course, Kerry wants him to come home, because under the Patriot Act, they'll whisk him off the plane and stick him in solitary confinement. You'll never see him again.
Right.
And I thought that was very interesting. And that's why Snowden is out, because he can't come home and stand. He will not be able to stand trial unless the Patriot Act is amended. And I think that is an incredible point that I've missed before, too. I thought he'd be able to come home, have due process, have his stay in court. He won't. He'll be thrown into the dungeon. Since we now have 4 vacancies at Guantanamo, that's what'll stick them. Excuse me, 5 vacancies.
Right. Actually, it's not so much the Patriot Act as the Espionage Act. No, it's the Espionage Act. And with that in force, basically, it would be a kangaroo court. He can't say or do anything. It's very much a one-sided version of the law. His defender can say, well, what about an objection? This might harm national security.
So that's the interesting thing, and that's why he stays around. Again, I think that what he's done is heroic, and someday we'll hopefully the truth will be cast out, and everyone will find out that he was telling the truth, and he'll be allowed to come back home and live a normal life again, and we may praise him. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I really believe what he's done. But let's face it, the barn door's open, the animals are already out. We all now know that we're being spied on at any moment, any time, anywhere, any place. The big thing that's coming to Ohio for the police officers now is crazy. They have these incredible, and I'm sure they have them in L.A., I'm probably in New Jersey too, Bill, because when I drove through there last weekend for Memorial Day, I could not believe how many state highway patrol officers I saw on 80 on our way to visit our daughter. But they have these cameras that automatically read the license plates in front of them. It's incredible. Without any the only probable cause is you're in front of the police officer, and they read the plates.
Well,
the
plate readers also pick up the plates of parked cars. Bet you didn't know that.
How quickly it's happened and how fast, and I think Peter goes on with what you were saying, is how our society has changed. There's good and bad with it. I just hope the powers that be strike that perfect balance. And then that's the only way our society is going to function in a free society, in a healthy society, in a good society, if the balance is struck. And right now I think the scales are so far out of whack that it's not going well. Now, maybe this debate of Snowden and others will bring it back, rein it in a little, rein it in a lot, I hope, and that we can have a free, successful society. But it just seems like the government's at one extreme, the spying's at one extreme, the super wealth is at one extreme, and everything's an extreme. And so I just hope that a portion of our society will be able to bring it back to the center. You know, we can, everyone will look better. I mean, maybe that's idealistic and naive, but it's certainly something I'd like to see happen.
Okay, I'm looking at the clock, and we're rapidly running out of time. Peter, any thoughts on the Snowden deal?
No, time will tell if he's how history will judge him, and I feel sorry for him. I think he's I think he made a big mistake doing everything that he did, and I think he's going to end up suffering more in the long run, but I could be wrong, and we'll just have to see how it all unfolds. It's going to take a while.
How about you, Bill?
The only positive thing is that people had kind of had their heads in the sand, not realizing how much NSA and other people were collecting about them. I also agree that he did make some very difficult decisions, and he has to pay for those decisions one way or another, even if it's he will be banished from the United States for the rest of his life. You know, that's a tough one. You know, despite everything that's wrong in the United States, this is still the greatest country in the world.
Okay, gentlemen, I have to drag this program to a close.
Oh, can I say one thing?
Sure.
I really want to pitch Gary off if he's listening. I want to thank, hats off to the Obama administration for bringing back Sergeant Bergdahl without firing a shot.
Oh, great story. But
it was a 5-for-1 trade.
Yeah.
I'll take it. I don't care if it's 50-for-1. I'm glad he's home. Well, on his way home.
Okay. Gentlemen, I do hope you'll be back next week for another adventure. And until then, I want to sincerely thank you for taking part. And we'll be back again next Sunday. Till then, goodbye.
Bye. Thank you.